Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. We are in the fourth Monday of our opera series, and I would like now to welcome Desiree Mays. She is an international lecturer on opera. She's the author of Opera Unveiled, which comes out every year to accompany the five operas of the Santa Fe Opera. She's also the director of Act One Tours, which we haven't really talked about that much yet, So we'll talk about that later today. Sure. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
So this is the, should we call it, obligatory atonal opera of the year?
No, it's not obligatory. It's just representing that time period in musical history which actually has passed. And many people think that's appropriate.
It has passed, hasn't it?
Pretty well, yes. We've moved out of the 12th tone. But actually, for this particular opera, you can't imagine this as a sort of glorious lyrical arias one after the other. It would be totally inappropriate. It's a very deep, sad, psychological, difficult piece.
And we're talking about Wozzeck by Alban Berg,
mm-hmm.
who spanned the late 19th, early 20th centuries.
That's right, yes. So a time of World War I, sort of in between the two World Wars. Alban Berg actually was a soldier, an infantryman, in the trenches and hated every minute of it. In fact, at one point he wrote to his wife, he said, "Have you ever been in a room where men are snoring, gasping, breathing heavily, and it's a sort of a cacophony of sound?" And you can imagine the scene. I mean, all these soldiers.
I think I'll write an opera.
Yeah, I think I'll write an opera. And he wrote it into the opera. I mean, it's Wozzeck in one scene. That's exactly what happens. You'll hear it. His army experience, so not all was lost.
So let's talk about the story of Wozzeck.
Maybe a little about the background first, how it came into being, because Wozzeck was a real person.
Yeah.
Do you want to start there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I love these operas that start with a true real-life person. I mean, that even included Faust, because Dr. Johannes Faust lived in the 15th century and got written up. In this case, it's a story from 1821. Johann Christian Wozzeck, which was his original name, a Slavic name, got changed in the course of history, crazed by jealousy, stabbed his mistress to death when she stood in her doorway. And this crime of passion was complicated by claims that Wozzeck was crazy at the time. And now steps in an early version of a forensic expert, a doctor, Dr. Claris, who studied Wozzeck a number of times and actually said that he was sane before, during, and after the murder. So he was tried, condemned, and publicly beheaded in the Market Square in Leipzig in 1824. And this is very interesting, this case, because it's the first case to come before a court where the jury's decision, the fate of the accused, rested on the report of the medical doctor. That was, I think that's an interesting little medical piece of trivia that applies. So it was written up, and a family in Germany heard this story at Gießen, Georg Buchner, and he became a professor at the Zurich University later on. He was a scientist and a political revolutionary, dramatist. He really changed the course of German theater. Probably German expressionism came out of this young man's writings. So he became fascinated by the story of Wozzeck, and he started putting it together. But then, sadly, he contracted typhoid fever and died in February 1837. He was only 23 years of age.
I mean, it is quite amazing when you think about it that somebody whose work revolutionized German theater only lived to be 23 years old.
Yeah, if you think about it. He didn't have an awful lot published, but he certainly made his mark. With this work, he left it in fragments. And the piece has always been very fragmentary, and maybe it needs to be. When it came to Alban Berg, he used this, and we'll talk about the structure of the piece in terms of its fragmentary sort of approach. But Buchner's focus was on the cry, "Wir arme Leute," we poor people. It's a sort of, that becomes the major motif, if you like, in both the play and the opera. Wozzeck is the anti-hero. the probably the forerunner, an early German expressionist theater that became so important. So the play then looks at, there's nothing romantic, I promise you, about this opera, about the play. It looks at his inner suffering, his state of mind. It sort of probes the irrational and the abnormal, the pathological aspects of this man's nature. So Wozzeck drifts in and out of reality, and it's not always clear where the borderline is. And I don't think that has changed with people who are severely troubled or set upon as he was. So the opera does have a sense of the surreal. And in this production, which we first presented at the Santa Fe Opera to amazing critical acclaim in 2001, does bring that out. So where the set is square at one point, as Wozzeck becomes madder and madder and he begins to lose sense of reality, the set fractures. Mm. And the angles change. That's the most incredible way of showing on a stage the internal workings of someone's mind.
Very interesting.
It's very affecting. And when you see it, it's very subtle, but as it is in the piece. So Buchner died, and then a German writer, Karl Emil von Franzos, began to pull the work together in 1879. He changed the ending. We don't have to go through a beheading at the end of this opera. You'll be glad to hear. That happens
in thank goodness.
The dialogue of the Carmelites with an go to the guillotine, not in this. They decided that they would end the story, both play and opera, where after Wozzeck has murdered his mistress, he goes back to find the knife, and he picks it up and he throws it further out into the lake or the pond, intending to lose the evidence. But in fact, he has lost touch with reality, so he wanders out into the lake and actually drowns. And it's not clear whether it's a death by drowning by choice or whether it was accidental. And we'll talk about that when we get to it. But maybe...
Well, I think just to go back for a moment to the thing you were saying before about the fragmentary nature of the story kind of reflecting the fragmentary nature of a mind that's becoming mm-hmm. deranged, this is all a really long time before James Joyce, before
yes.
Cubism, before any of that. It was really kind of artistically prescient.
Yeah, it was really amazing that this young writer, Georg Buchner, had this ability, foresight, and really chose to interpret this situation this way. But he was a political activist. He saw the horror of how the people, the common people were being treated. And in this work, he really points that up. So you have to raise the question of who is sane and who is crazy in the course of the piece because of the inhumane way in which he is treated. And thousands of people were at that time. So he's taking up a cause. There is a political angle to this, which I think is as relevant today as it was then.
And as we've discussed, you can when you start looking at the range of operas that are presented, some of them work with characters who are kings and queens and mythological figures and mm-hmm. towering types of one kind, archetypes. And then some of them are really ordinary people at the mm-hmm. level of the streets, people ignored by society, by art, by the authorities, or
right.
or oppressed by them.
Exactly, the oppressed end of any culture, of sociological groups. So it's interesting that it does cover all of this. So I think you know, Marichard, whether they're kings, queens, the aristocracy, or poor people, many of the issues are regardless of class and caste. The love, hate, revenge, need for love, longing, all of the issues that are expressed in Romanticism are still things that we feel today, and it doesn't matter what our background is. The need for love, longing, understanding, all of those good things.
So shall we hear the first clip of music?
Yes, I think we should. And this is a good way into this. I think Wir arme Leute, it's when Wozzeck at the very beginning of the opera he's a manservant for a captain and he's shaving him. And the captain has criticized him because he has a child out of wedlock. And up to this point, Wozzeck has been monosyllabic. That's another thing about this opera. These people are inarticulate. It's really amazing, an opera. We'll talk about how they deal with that.
usually they're quite verbose.
Oh yeah, typically, yes, at length and repeating themselves over and over. So in this, however, now he takes a stand for his child. Wir arme Leute, poor folk like us, money you see, with no money, nothing at all. We're all made of flesh and blood. If I were a gentleman and wore a top hat and had a watch, I could talk politely. I could be virtuous, too. It must be beautiful to have virtue, but I'm only a simple soul. Folk like us are always unfortunate in this world and the other world. I think if we got into heaven, we'd have to be the thunder makers. It's a great line. Let's listen to that. And that is the great aria, if you can call it that, from the opera Wozzeck by Urban Berg, Wir arme Leute. I'm using a really wonderful recording here, Mary Charlotte. The conductor is Dimitri Mitropoulos. It's an older recording, Wozzeck, Mac Harrell, we heard there, and Marie, his girlfriend, is Eileen Farrell. We'll get to her next.
Well, one of the things that you were writing about in Opera Unveiled, Desiree, is that the music changes quite dramatically throughout this. It's not just the style of singing that we just heard. That's not the whole entire opera.
No, it's a very interesting piece, the way Berg approaches this. Berg, to begin with, was a pupil of Arnold Schoenberg, and Webern was his friend. These were the people who, the 12-tone style that most people are still a little skeptical about, it's atonal, there are no lovely melodies typically in this. So this was where he was trained, and much of this music is in that sort of minor dissonant feel to it. It puts you a little off edge. It's not easy to, you don't enjoy this, I don't think. But then this is a character who's really suffering, and that suffering is carried across the footlights into the audience, I suppose.
So we
by means
suffer.
Of the music, we suffer with him to a certain extent. I mean, don't we? You watch King Lear and you suffer with the horrors that he goes through with Hamlet when he's having his internal struggles. I mean, it's a facet of theater. But with Berg, he uses actually many different styles. And we talked a little bit about the fragmentary aspect of this opera. So let me give you a little sense of the structure. It's in 15 scenes and 3 acts. Well, now, for starters, that sounds like it's going to last all night. It's actually a 90-minute piece, and it's performed without an intermission, which makes good sense, I think, because to leave that you build the drama in this piece and to go and have an intermission and go back to it, you destroy the, what you've set up in the early part. So within this structure, the first act, for instance, of 5 scenes are 5 character pieces with a suite, a rhapsody, a march, and a rondo. Then in the second, this is where the characters are introduced, and the development then of the plot, that's a symphony in 5 movements. And then the final section, Act 3, is 6 inventions. And you'll hear how amazing this is. I mean, an invention on one note, on a rhythm, on a 6-note chord, on one key. And you think, how is that going to be? That's a variation. In one of these little scenes, there's a six-note chord. And there are 21 variations in this very brief little scene. So you don't actually pick that up. And in the end of all this, I mean, Berg said it actually, I think, very well when he when he talked about this opera, let me see if I can find the quote here, since I'm quoting the master himself. He said that we should follow the drama and let the music take hold as and when it will. Now, I think that's the best way to approach this opera. You can dissect it, and for a musician, that's interesting. But for the, you know, for most of us who don't have that musical background, it's not necessary. But there is variety. I mean, at one point he goes off into the fields, Wozzeck with his friend Andreas, and Andreas sings a little folk song that we can identify with, while Wozzeck is seeing things. He's seeing hedgehogs, rolling heads, lights coming out of the sky. He's going crazy. And the trombones are erupting. And the fact that you have this very normal little folk song going on against his hallucinations really offsets it and points it up. It's very effective. But then he is capable of melody too. So I'd like to play next, perhaps, Marie's Lullaby. Wozzeck is he's really being put down by everyone, by the captain who treats him like dirt, and then by a doctor. There's a doctor who he's earning a few pennies from by being literally an experimental animal, because this doctor wants to see how people would survive on a diet of beans. Only
that's,
beans.
That's, I mean,
it's bizarre. So is it surprising his mind is wandering, because that's all he's eating and he's out of it? But he earns a few pennies to give to Marie.
I did read that and think, what? I mean, is this based on some kind of real stories of doctors using their, Lord knows there have been doctors using their patients for experiments, but
exactly.
That's a pretty weird one.
It absolutely is, and it says that this doctor, I mean, he suggests that he'd rather have his patients dead because then he can do more inhuman experiments on them. I mean, and that did happen at the time. So the doctor's delighted that he's going crazy. So the question actually comes up, who is the crazy character here? Is it the doctor and the captain? They are caricatured and they're parodied. They are the worst of their society. Whereas Wozzeck is hypersensitive. If anything, he feels too much. He's a very sensitive character. So when they push him around like this, he does suffer. And physically he's suffering and his mind is wandering, but he does it just to earn a few pennies for Marie, who is his girlfriend and the mother of their child. But Marie is confused too. It's difficult for her. Wozzeck is losing it. He shows up from time to time and sometimes he seems completely crazy. And one day she's standing in her door when the military band comes by and she sees the drum major and she's attracted to him. And her friend Marta says to her, you know, you're always flirting with the guys. And she's very angry, so she slams her window shut and goes indoors. And when she's in the house, she picks up the child and sings a lullaby to their child. And this is a lullaby of a woman who is desperate. She is a cradle song, a Ländler, a sort of a folk dance in 3/4 time, a lullaby we can identify with. And it sort of drifts off nowhere at the end. Berg said that this scene describes, in his words, Marie's aimless and indefinable attitude of waiting, which will find its final solution only in death. There's no hope for these people. They're in extreme poverty, and it's a hopeless situation. But she sings a lullaby, and this is Eileen Farrell singing the lullaby to her child.
Oh,
that, Desiree, we're listening to pieces from the opera Wozzeck. And I was thinking as I was watching it on DVD last night and thinking, if I were trained as an opera singer, what kind of extra training do you have to, I mean, if you're used to singing Baroque operas or classical or romantic mm-hmm. operas, do you have to bring to learn to sing this kind of opera?
Well, this would be part of one's training. I think Sprechstimme, it's called. It's sort of a spoken, half-sung, half-spoken way of interpreting the score. I think it's nothing in comparison to what singers are being asked to do these days. So singers have to be able to attempt all of these extraordinary things that are asked of them. Actually, in the olden days, in the time of Vivaldi, whom we'll talk about next week, there were extraordinary coloratura cadenzas where the singers had to achieve extraordinary leaps and bounds in their voices and do it with a bel canto sound, still sound a beautiful, not a screechy voice when you're doing it. That was in its time very demanding. So this has a different kind of demand. It has to be very intense. It has to be very believable. In the scene I'm going to play you, to give you an example of this, between Marie and Wozzeck, the audience have to be drawn into the intensity of what's going on with them, because they are, as I said, sort of inarticulate. It's very difficult for these people to communicate, to put words to what they're feeling. So Sprechstimme is this sort of half-sung, half-spoken lines. It's sort of a rhythmic speech in which the line is given in a speaking tone, but there's a strict rhythm underneath that tone. And for this work, it gives it a very sort of unreal, surreal feel to it, that they are out of touch, which of course they are. So that's what Sprechstimme is. And I found it very interesting. Just coming in today, I realized that some of the greatest baritones have chosen to take on this role. It's not that it's an opera that anyone can sing. You need to be very established and have that built-in intensity. We'll have that with Richard Porfink. He's going to be singing Wozzeck this summer. He's an extraordinary singer and has an international career. I can't wait to hear him sing this role. So.
Excuse the naive question, but is it harder to memorize and therefore sing scores like this that have no melodies?
I wonder. That's a question for a singer, but again, part of their training, because today singers have to sing in Russian and I imagine Chinese. They have to be able to master these languages and not just sing them by rote, by the words, but to understand what's going on so that you could. I once interviewed a Carmen who was French, and she didn't speak Spanish or Italian. So she was doing it by rote, and she really didn't understand what was going on with the. I mean, that doesn't make sense. And today, the training for these young singers is so broad. They are expected to speak a number of different languages. I mean, imagine learning Eugene Onegin or the Queen of Spades in Russian. It's a long role, and for anyone who's in it, and they must be able to do that.
You know, there's an interesting analogy to dancers. We talk about ballet dancers who 30, 40, 50 years ago, learned ballet. Now mm-hmm. they're learning ballet, jazz,
yes.
and all kinds, you know, even hip-hop and all these things are in every young dancer's repertoire.
That's right. When I was trained as a classical dancer, you know, modern dance, contemporary dance, we looked down our noses at. It was swans and point shoes or nothing. But I was in London right at the time this was changing. So when we began to take modern dance lessons, as they were called, it was actually very freeing, because the classical style is so structured. Every muscle in your body has to be in a prescribed position at all times. And contemporary dance gives a lot more freedom. You don't have to have your feet turned out from the hip from beginning to end. You can wear bare feet. You know, have bare feet. So so it's part of the evolution, I suppose, of the art form. It's a good analogy to say that with dance, because they must be able to do that. Aspen Santa Fe Ballet is great for this. These are classically trained dancers who are magnificent contemporary dancers. You can throw anything at them and they can do it.
Yeah.
But in dance, there's a little bit, perhaps, more leeway again, because many choreographers give the dancers as their heads, and they can invent the choreography. It's not always up to the choreographer, so there's another freedom there. With these scores, you don't have that. You know, you don't have that capability. Though there's always the question of, you know, how are these operas going to be presented today, since we're in the age of régie théâtre, especially in Europe, where it's the idea, the concept of the director that is very important, and we're seeing this more and more in different productions. Not a lot of it has filtered through here yet, which is probably a good thing. Some of these are shocking from many points of view. Some of these productions are done just for shock value, which I think has no justification. But a director once said to me, if these operas are updated and made more present and relevant in a contemporary context, and if it's done with integrity, then it can work. And that's true. Now, this piece was maybe one of the first where you see the bare, dark stage, where this box that Wozzeck is encased in, it could be the frame of his brain, which is very Beckett, that, you know, the whole thing is going on inside his troubled brain. But there is no sense of his ever being able to go beyond the box. The only way out for him is madness and death. Anyway, maybe we should play a little of this scene where Wozzeck confronts Marie. She has been flirting with the drum major, and the drum major has embraced her, and she pushed him away. But he insisted he's going to have his way with her. And finally, the desperate Marie just shrugs her shoulders and says, "What does it matter?" And she goes into the house with him. And then she has these moments of remorse, and she's in her house with the child when Wozzeck comes bursting in, and he sees that she's wearing an earring. And she says, "Oh, it's one I picked up in the street." She was given the earrings by the drum major. And then he sees the second one. He said, "What, you found a pair in the street?" So this starts an argument, and they get into a fight over the earrings because he knows that she has been unfaithful. And this really triggers his madness. So,
but wait a minute. She's been unfaithful, but hadn't he already left her?
No, he's still with her. Oh, okay. As much as he can be. He's a soldier, so he has to sleep in the barracks. And he has a girlfriend on the side. I mean, they're not married. She's a girlfriend, the mother of the child. And he comes at one point and just gives her money through the window to pay the rent. And she's very grateful. And it's a tender moment. But then in this scene, he confronts her about her unfaithfulness. And it's the beginning of the end for him in terms of his madness. So this is Wozzeck confronting Marie. And the style of singing is Sprechstimme, half-spoken, half-sung.
Guten Franz. Ich seh nichts. Oh, man muss sehen. Man muss greifen können mit den Fäusten.
Was hast du, Franz?
Bist du's doch, Marie? Einer Sünde, so dick und breit. Das muss stinken, dass man die Engel zum Himmel hinaus räuchern könnt. Aber du hast einen roten Mund, einen roten Mund. Keine Blase drauf.
Du bist hier wichtig, Franz. Ich fürchte mich.
Du bist schön wie die Sünde. Aber kann die Todsünde so schön sein, Marie? Da hat er da gestanden. So, so.
Ich kann den Leuten die Gassen nicht verbieten.
Heute hat er da gestanden.
Die Feier der Tag lang und die Welt alt ist. Können viele Menschen an einem Platz stehen, eine Nacht im Haus.
Haben gesehen!
Man kann viel sehen, wenn man zwei Augen hat und wenn man nicht blind ist und wenn die Sonne scheint.
Oh, mein
Lieb! Und
Mensch!
Nehme ich dich an! Lieber ein Messer in als eine Hand auf mich. Mein Vater hat's nicht gewagt, ich 10 Jahre alt war.
Lieber ein Messer. Der Messer. Mensch ist ein Abgrund. Es schwindelt einem, wenn man hinunterschaut. Mich schwindelt.
Listening to music from Wojciech, which is one of the operas at the Santa Fe Opera this year. This is our fourth in our series of Opera Mondays with Desiree Mays. Why don't we take a little break right now to hear from our beloved underwriters, and we will be right back. And we're back with Desiree Mays talking about the opera Wojciech. Now, let's go on with the story. Well, one of the things that we have in the opera is that there is a scene with a band in it, and the band on the stage is made up
band
of...
Band on stage, yes.
Yeah. Are they actually playing music, or are they acting?
Oh, no, they play. No, they play. It's the musicians are in costume on stage. It's a tavern scene, a German beer garden, the real thing. I mean, it really is. These poor people have very little, but they go to the tavern to drink those big steins of beer. And these are the apprentices, the soldiers. Wojciech is a soldier, and he has had a bad night. Because when he is asleep in the barracks with all of his friends, and this is where that snoring, gasping, groaning scene comes in, the polyphony of that. I mean, if you know that when you listen to it, you think, yeah, this actually makes sense, you know, that strange sound of sleeping with lots of strangers and that weird sound. So the door bursts open, the drum major comes in, and he gloats over Wojciech, and Wojciech is angered, and the two get into a fight, and the drum major beats him up and then throws him down on the ground, storms out, and the men just roll over and go back to sleep. They really don't give a damn about Wojciech. But then the next day, they're all at the tavern drinking heavily, I imagine. The musicians are on stage, and it's a wild sort of dance. There's a wildness to it. Marie is dancing with the drum major. Imadzu, Imadzu, on we go. There's sort of a real erotic feel to their dance that they may not be so aware of, but Wojciech is going crazy with this. He's watching it, and he's very angry. Let's play a little of this waltz. You'll hear some of the sort of the strange undertow of what's going on here. And that is Wojciech having to sit by and watch as his girlfriend Marie dances by with the drum major. And when they waltz off, he sits, and the idiot, there's an idiot in this piece, sidles up to him and says, "Blood, blood." He sees blood, and Wojciech picks up on this, and blood and the idea of a knife. At one point when he and Marie are arguing, she says, "Take your hands off me, better a knife blade." And he makes this sort of loose connection between a knife blade and blood. She has been home and is desperate. She reads from the Bible. She's desperate for help. And she reads the story of Mary Magdalene, and she cries out, "Savior, as thou hadst mercy on her." Now Have Mercy on Me. Now, this is the final act, which is the inventions that you asked about. So maybe I could read a little bit from Afron Vale to describe the murder scene. This is an invention on a single note, B, and we're going to hear that with extraordinary effect. At dusk, Marie walks with Wozzeck in the forest by a pond. She's nervous. It's cold and late. Wozzeck has her sit down. Are you frightened? All heaven I would give if I could always kiss you, but no. The music is calm and brooding, and then to the sound of muted brass becomes menacing as a red moon rises. Like blood-red steel, Wozzeck cries as he draws a knife and shouts, if not me, no one. He stabs Marie repeatedly. She falls and dies. Tot, dead, says Wozzeck, as the entire orchestra builds to a crescendo on the single note of B. And you'll hear this. You have to put yourself into his shoes. Everything has turned to blood. She's covered in blood. She's dead. The water is turning red at his feet, and there is blood in his head and in his eyes. It's all that he can see. And the way Berg interprets this with these two chords is chilling. And then it suddenly breaks up and goes back to the tavern scene you'll hear at the end of this, where they're dancing again and he's joined the crowd, but Marie is dead.
Once again, music from the opera Wozzeck. This is tough opera.
It is. It's not easy. But not all theatre has to be entertaining or fun, I think. Sometimes we like to be thought-provoked, if you like.
What's its effect on you when you've seen it?
When I had to come back to doing it again, I had a sort of sense of, oh, that's such a dark piece. Am I up for this? And then I started working on it. And then, I primarily work with these operas with CDs, not with videos, partly because if you see a video, it predisposes you to how you think it should be. And if you're just left with the music, you have to imagine it yourself. And I can study the music better that way. And it really draws you in. And this is a great theater piece. Beyond anything else, this is a piece you want to sit in the theater. And as time goes on, even if you may resist it in the beginning, you're drawn into his suffering and his pain. And even though he's the killer in the opera, he's the one where our sympathies lie, because we're seeing how the underdog is treated. This is an opera about man's inhumanity to man and the horrible things that happen. When Wojciech drowns, for instance, the captain, the doctor are walking nearby and they hear a splashing in the pond. And one says to the other, oh, it sounds like someone's drowning. And they say, oh, yes, doesn't it? You know, let's walk on. They choose to ignore, to do nothing.
Do they know it's him?
They don't know that it's Wojciech, but the fact that it's anybody out there needing help. There's no help for anyone in this opera. And this, I think, is a very contemporary statement of a state of affairs, too. You know, we tend to walk by when maybe we could help, and it always puts us on the spot. It's difficult. This opera puts you on the spot a bit, you know, emotionally, because it does open you up, even if you resist it at the beginning, because it's not easy. The music's not easy. The story is rough. But it can open you up, and you do find yourself empathizing and feeling for this this tragic character. He is a tragic character. And tragedy has many components. It's not romantic, as I said, in the score, the way it's treated. It's very real. It's actually all too real, which is why a lot of people might not like it. But again, if you're watching it, and if you see the set, which has been a sort of a solid square set, begin to fracture as he does, your heart goes out to him. You know what's happening. So finally, in the end, he's in the tavern scene. You've heard there, Marta is dancing, and she sees blood on his hands, and everybody gathers round, and they see blood on his clothes, and the music just goes crazy, and he runs away back to the pond and sees Marie and wonders why she looks so strange. She's dead, and he is totally out of it by now. He finds the knife, and he picks it up, throws it far out into the pond, where it sinks. You have that sort of ripple effect as he wades out after it, and he begins to think that the water is all blood. And it's not clear whether he chooses, in his mental state, he just goes into the water and he dies. And the music is very beautiful at that point. There's a real sense of the swirling of the water described in strings and woodwinds and brass as Wojciech dies. Maybe we could play that little section right now.
Aber der Mond verrät mich. Der Mond ist blutig. Will denn die ganze Welt es ausblasen? Verschwessen, es liegt zu weit vorn. Sie finden's beim Baden oder wenn sie nach Muscheln tauchen. Ich bin's nicht. Aber ich muss mich waschen. Ich bin blutig. Da und weg. Und noch einer. Weh! Ich wasche mich mit Blut. Und das Wasser ist Blut.
Hören. it's not good to be here. That's the last line that we heard there. So he dies. And then Berg does a very interesting thing. He almost seems to step back from the drama, the composer. And there's a final interlude. There's wonderful interludes in this opera that are worth trying to sort of separate your eyes and your heart from watching the action, what's going on stage, to listening to the music, to these interludes. In this particular one, he seems to pay homage to Wozzeck, the man who has died in such dire circumstances. And it's a very tender moment, this final interlude where the composer steps back and sort of assesses what's happened. And then at the very end, there's a little scene where we all return to harsh reality and the bright light of day, to a scene of children playing. They're 3, 4, 5 year olds, they're skipping about, and one of them has a little hobby horse. That child is Wozzeck and Marie's child, now an orphan. And the kids jump about saying, "Oh, Marie died. We're going to the pond to see what happened," as kids do, and they go flying off. And the little boy, who is uncomprehending at the very end of the opera, it's an extraordinarily touching moment, he turns, and on his hobby horse, he hops off after them, not knowing what he's going to see. So the very final piece maybe we can play from this is the interlude from the end of Wozzeck by Orban Berg. So we came
to the end
of Wozzeck.
And so that last part was like a movie score bad stuff has all come down.
Yes, exactly. It's a great big orchestra in this piece. And as I say, worth listening to the musical interludes. They're quite lovely. But it's a difficult piece, but it's there's much to be gained from this. I think you come out thinking about it.
Well, Wozzeck is the opera by Alban Berg. And the premiere was in 1925. And mm-hmm. It opens here at the Santa Fe Opera on the 30th of July, which is a Saturday. There's only 4 shows. So if people are interested, and, you know, sometimes I think that musicians are particularly into this kind of music because they play this and they know it and they feel it deeply in a way that sometimes
the rest of us don't.
Yeah, we laymen.
Yeah, they have that deep understanding. You know, I love talking to musicians because they can open up windows for you in these operas that are really revelatory. And then, again, like any opera, Marichard, if you know the story ahead of time, definitely with this. And if you have a chance to hear the score, it's really worthwhile because by the time that you're in the house, you're able to be open to, you know, what's going on and emotionally, you get it much easier.
Desiree Mays is an international lecturer on opera. She's the author of Opera Unveiled. The Santa Fe Opera is at santafeopera.org. And to get tickets, the box office numbers are 800-280-4654. And here in New Mexico, 505-986-5900. Desiree, thank you so much. And we'll see you next week for our last opera, Griselda.
Griselda, yes.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering this and all the opera shows. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.